Men had stopped work along the length of the irregular pit. Others had lined the causeway high above, and there was an ugly mood on all of them that was broken by a clear young voice speaking in the cadence and intonation of a refined English gentleman. "Major Ballantyne, that is you, is it not?" And peering up at the causeway, Zuger recognised Neville Pickering, his drinking companion from the first day in the London hotel. "It is indeed, Mr. Pickering." "That's all right, fellows. I'll vouch for Major Ballantyne. He's the famous elephant hunter, don't you know?" Almost immediately they lost interest and turned away to become absorbed once more in their own race to get the buckets of gravelly yellow stuff to the surface. "Thank you," Zuger called up to the man on the causeway above him. "My pleasure, sir." Pickering flashed a brilliant smile, touched the brim of his hat, and sauntered away, a slim and elegant figure in the press of bearded dust-cake diggers. Zuger was left alone. As alone in spirit as he had ever been in any of his wanderings across the vast African continent. He had spent almost the last penny he owned on these few square feet of yellow earth, at the bottom of this hot and dusty pit. He had no men to help him work it, no experience, no capital. And he doubted that he would recognise an uncut diamond if he held one in the palm of his hand. As suddenly as it had descended upon him, the gambler's elation, the premonition of good fortune that awaited him here, evaporated. He was instantly overwhelmed by his own presumption and by the enormity of the gamble he was taking. He had risked it all on claims that so far had not yielded a single good stone. The price of diamonds was plummeting. The pool goods, small splints of half a carat or less, which formed the vast bulk of stones recovered, were fetching only 5 shillings each. It was a wild chance, and his stomach slid sickeningly as he faced the consequences of failure. The sun was almost directly overhead, burning down into the bottom of the workings. The air around him wavered with the heat, and it came up through the leather of his boots to scorch the soles of his feet. He felt as though he was suffocating, as though he could not bear it another moment, as though he must scramble up out of this loathsome pit to where the air was cooler and sweeter. He knew then he was afraid. It was an emotion to which he was not accustomed. He had stood down the charge of a wounded bull elephant and taken his chance, man to man, steel to steel, on the frontiers of India and in the wild border wars of the Cape. He was not accustomed to feeling fear, but the waves of panic rose up out of some dark place in his soul, and he fought to control them. The sense of impending disaster crushed down upon him. Under his feet he could almost feel the sterility of the baking earth, the barren earth, which would cripple him at last, and destroy the dream which had been the fuel on which his life had run for all these years. Was it all to end here in this hot and hellish pit? He took a deep breath and held it for a moment, fighting off the waves of blind panic, and slowly they receded, leaving him feeling weak and shaken, as though from a heavy dose of malarial fever. He went down on one knee and took a handful of the yellow stuff, sifting it through his fingers, and then examined the residue of dull and worthless pebbles. He let them drop and dusted his hand against his thigh. He had beaten back the engulfing panic, but he was left with a terrible sense of despondency and a weariness that ached in his bones so that he hardly had strength enough to climb the swaying rope ladder, and his feet dragged and scuffed the ochre-red earth of the track, while around him the encampment swam and wavered in the heat and dust as he started back towards the outspan. Above the hubbub of the camp, a clear, childish voice rang, and Zuger lifted the golden beard from his chest, his mood lightening as he recognised his son's sweet piping tones. "Papa! Oh, papa!" Jordan was racing towards him, wild abandon in every frantic pace, his arms pumping and his feet flying over the rutted track, while the mass of silken curls flew above his lovely face. "Oh, papa, we have searched for you all night, all day." "What is it, Jordan?" The child's distress alarmed Zuger afresh, and he started forward. Jordan reached him and threw both arms about Zuger's waist. He pressed his face to Zuger's coat front, so that his voice was muffled, and he trembled like a frightened little wild animal. "It's Mama! Something has happened to Mama! Something terrible has happened!" The delirium of typhoid fever came upon a letter in hot grey fog banks that blotted out reality and filled her head with phantoms and fantasies, which cleared abruptly, leaving her too weak to sit upright. But with her senses enhanced so that her hot skin was hypersensitive to the touch of the clammy flannel against her face, and the oppressive weight of her clothing threatened to smother her. Her vision was sharp, and the images enlarged, as though seen through a fine reading glass. She could study each long, curved eyelash that made up the dense fringe about Jordan's beautiful green eyes. She could see each individual pore in the satiny skin of his cheeks, could delight in the texture of his perfectly bowed lips that trembled now with his agitation and fear as he stooped over her. She was lost in wonder at her son's beauty. And then the roaring started in her ears again, and the beloved child's face receded, until she was looking at it down a long, narrow tunnel through the roaring darkness. She clung desperately to the image, but it began to turn, slowly at first, like the wheel of a carriage, then faster still, until Jordan's face blurred dizzily, and she felt herself tumbling down into the humid darkness again, like a leaf upon the roaring wind. Again the darkness opened, a veil drawn aside in some deep place in her head, and with joy she sought the boy's face again, but instead she saw the falcon high above her. It was the bird figure of the graven idol that had always been a part of her life since Zuga had come into it. At every cottage, at every outspan or room that they had called home for a day or a week or a month, that stone idol seemed to have been there with them, silent, implacable, heavy with a brooding and ancient malevolence. She had always hated that idol, had always sensed the aura of evil that surrounded it. But now her hatred and her fear could focus fully upon the stone bird that stood tall above the cot on which she lay. She cursed it weakly, silently, lying on her back on the narrow cot, the robe she wore clinging damply to her skin with the fever sweat, and she mouthed her hatred at the stone image that towered above her on its polished green soapstone column. Again her vision narrowed, became concentrated, so that the falcon head was her whole existence. Then, miraculously, the blank stone eyes began to glow with a strange golden light. They revolved slowly in the sockets of the polished stone skull, and suddenly they were looking down at her. The pupils were black and glossy, alive and seeing, but cruel, and so truly evil that she quailed in terror, staring up at the bird. The curved stone beak opened. The tongue was sharp as an arrowhead, and from its tip was suspended a single perfect ruby drop of blood in which a star of light glowed. And Aletta knew it was the blood of the sacrifice. The darkness about the bird was filled with moving shadows, the wraiths of the sacrificial victims, the shades of the falcon priests, dead these thousand years, gathering again to reinforce the powers, gathering again to welcome her. She screamed, again and again, her terror ringing insanely in her own ears, and then firm hands were shaking her gently, tenderly. Her vision cleared again, but not completely. Everything was dim and blurred. So she screwed up her eyes, still panting wildly from her screams. "Ralph, is that you?" The strong, dark features, already taking on the set of manhood, so different from the sweet angel face of his brother, were close above her. "Don't take on so, Mama. Ralphie, why is it so dark?" she mumbled. "It's night time. Where is Geordie?" "He is asleep, Mama. He could not keep awake. I sent him to sleep." "Call Papa," she whispered. "Jan Sharoot is searching for him. He will come soon." I am cold." She was trembling violently, and felt him draw the rough blanket up beneath her chin, before she sank back into the darkness. In the darkness, she saw the shapes of men hurrying forward, pressing about her. She caught their urgency, the passion of their terrible purpose, and she saw their arms glint in the shadows, the flash of white steel, bared and honed for war. She heard the snick of breech block, the rattle of bayonet in the scabbard, and here and there in the press she recognised a face, faces she had never seen before, but which she recognised instantly with a clairvoyant flash of intuition. One was a man full-grown, bearded, strong, who was her son, riding into war, and others, so many others, her blood, her flesh, her bones going forward in that awful expectant throng. She was consumed with terrible grief for them, but she could not weep. Instead, she lifted her eyes and saw the falcon on high, clear in the single brilliant shaft of sunshine that pierced the sombre and ominous clouds that rolled from horizon to horizon, the dun and terrible clouds of war. The falcon hovered on outstretched pinions against the belly of the clouds, twisting the cruelly beautiful head to peer down. Then the long pointed wings folded, and the bird dropped in a stoop like the lightning bolt, the great talons reaching forward in the strike. She saw them hook into living flesh, saw the grimace on the face that she had never seen before, but knew as deeply as she did her own. And she screamed again. Then strong arms held her, the familiar, beloved arms for which she had waited so long. She looked up at him, the clear emerald eyes so close to hers, the powerful jut of his jawline half-masked by the full golden-streaked beard. "Zuga," she breathed. "I am here, my love." The phantoms receded. The terrible nightmare world of her delirium was gone, and she found herself in a tent upon a dusty plain beneath a half-ruined hillock, and the bright African sunlight through the tent opening cut a stark slash of white light across the powdered red dust floor. She was mildly amazed by the swift transition from night to noonday, from fantasy to reality, and her mouth and throat were filled with the dry chalk of terrible thirst. "I am thirsty," she whispered huskily. He held the pitcher to her cracked lips, and the coolness and the sweetness of the liquid in her throat made her vision swim with delight. But immediately afterwards, the memory of the nightmares assailed her, and she darted a fearful glance across the tent at the silent statue. It seemed suddenly harmless, insignificant, the image blind and dumb, but a flicker of the night's terror remained. "Beware the falcon," she whispered, and she saw in his green eyes that he thought her words were still fever ravings. She wanted to convince him, but she was terribly, deadly tired. She closed her eyes and slept in his arms. When she awoke, the sun's rays had mellowed to a glorious orange light that filled the whole tent and lit little stars in Zuga's beard and curls. She was filled with a deep sense of peace. His arms were so strong, so all-encompassing. "Look after my babies," she said softly, but very clearly. And then she died. Aletta's grave was just another mound of red dirt in the long, neat row of freshly turned mounds. After he had buried her, Zuga sent the boys back to the outspan with Jan Sharut. Jordan was weeping inconsolably, his lovely face smudged with grief. Ralph sat behind his brother on the back of the gaunt bay gelding, holding the smaller child with both arms clasped about his waist. Ralph was silent, stoic, but his body was rigid with controlled emotion, and his eyes, the same clear, deep green of his father's, smouldered with unexpressed grief. Jan Sharut led the bay, and the two boys seemed as frail and forlorn as swallows left on a fence rail long after the others had flown the oncoming winter. Zuga stood beside the grave with military bearing, as expressionless as his elder son had been, but behind the handsome mask he was stunned by his own sorrow and pervading sense of guilt. He wanted to speak aloud, to tell Aletta that he was sorry, that he knew that he was responsible for this lonely grave, so far from her loving family and the beautiful forested mountains of Good Hope, which he had loved so dearly. He wanted to ask for forgiveness for sacrificing her to a dream, an impossible, grandiose dream, yet he knew that words were futile, and the red earth stopped Aletta's ears. He stooped, and with his bare hand dressed the mound where the earth had collapsed at one corner. "With the first diamond I will buy the headstone," he promised himself silently. The red earth had stained under his fingernails little half-moons, the colour of blood. With a supreme effort, he overcame his sense of futility, overcame the self-consciousness sufficiently to speak aloud to someone who could not hear. "I will look after them, my dear," he said. "That is my last promise to you." "Geordie will not eat, Papa," Ralph greeted him as he stooped into the tent, and Zuger felt the leap of alarm swamp his sorrow and his guilt. He strode to the cot on which the child lay, facing the canvas wall of the tent with his knees drawn up to his chest. Jordan's skin was burning hot as the sun scorched rocks that littered the plain outside the tent, and his silken cheeks, smeared with tears, were flushed a furious fever red. By morning Ralph was feverish also, both boys tossing and muttering in delirium, their bodies hot as two little furnaces, the blankets sodden with their sweat, and the tent reeking with the carrion stench of fever. Ralph fought the fever. "Jar, just look at him!" Jan Sharoot paused fondly in the act of sponging down the robust, strong-boned body. "He takes a sickness like an enemy and struggles with it." Helping him, kneeling on the opposite side of the cot, Zuger felt the familiar glow of pride surface through his concern as he looked down at him. Already there were little smoky wisps of hair under Ralph's arms, and a darker explosion of curls at the base of his belly. And his penis was no longer the little worm-like appendage, with a childish cap of wrinkled loose skin. His shoulders were squaring and filling with muscle, and his legs were straight and sturdy. "He will be all right," Jan Sharoot repeated, and Ralph thrashed out angrily in his delirium, his features scowling and dark with determination. The two men drew the blanket up over him and turned to the other cot. Jordan's long, thick lashes fluttered like the wings of a beautiful butterfly, and he whimpered pitifully, unresisting as they stripped and sponged him. His little body was as sweetly formed as his features, but clad still in its puppy fat, so that his buttocks were round as apples and plump as a girl's. But his limbs were delicately boned and shapely, his feet and hands long and narrow and graceful. "Mama," he whimpered, "I want my mama." The two men nursed the boys, taking turns day and night, everything else neglected or forgotten, an hour snatched here to water and tend the horses, another hour for a hurried journey into the camp to purchase patent medicine from a transport rider, or scrambled for the few vegetables offered for sale on the farmers' carts. But diamonds were forgotten, never mentioned in the hot little tent where the struggle for life went on and the devil's own claims were abandoned and deserted. In 48 hours Ralph had regained consciousness. In 3 days he was sitting up unaided and wolfing his food. In 6 days they could no longer keep him in the cot. Jordan rallied briefly on the second day, becoming lucid and demanding his mother fretfully, and then remembered that she was gone, began weeping again, and immediately began to sink. His life teetered, the pendulum swinging erratically back and forth, but each time he fell back, the presence of death grew stronger in the baking canvas tent, until its stench overpowered the odour of fever. The flesh melted from his body, burned away by the fever, and his skin took on a pearly translucent sheen, so that it seemed in that uncertain light of dusk and early dawn that the very outline of the delicate bone structure showed through. Jan Sharoot and Zuger nursed him in turns, one sleeping while the other watched, or when neither could sleep, sitting together, seeking comfort and companionship from each other, trying to discount their helplessness in the face of onrushing death. "He's young and strong," they told each other. "He'll be all right also." And day after day Jordan sank lower, his cheekbones rising up out of his flesh, and his eyes receding into deep cavities, the colour of old bruises.